Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gentius, a counseling faculty at Kent State University and host of Circular Firing Squad. We've got five members, five questions, and five answers for each question. Questions are generated from each squad member and run from the smart to the sassy. Let's find out who's with us tonight.
Hi, everybody. Elliot Ingersoll from Cleveland State University and host of Apply Topically.
Hey, everyone. Jen Cook, Associate Professor, University of Texas at San Antonio.
Hey, everybody. Mitch Conrad, second year graduate student at Cleveland State University.
Hi, everyone. Gina Martin, Assistant Professor at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater.
Elliot, you've got the first question tonight.
Okie doke. What do you feel about the current state of book publishing?
Well, I'm not even sure what we mean by this question. I've been kicking it around in my head because I'm thinking about it, I guess, for our profession is where I went with it in my mind. And, you know, I'm doing it for the first time right now. And so I don't know if I really understand fully what goes on behind the curtain. Like, I was surprised when I found out that our book was going to be peer reviewed. I had no idea that that was part of the publication process. I've never had an author come back and say, oh, we just finished the peer review and here's your edits. I had no idea about that. But I get the impression that I think that they're trying to get more creative with what gets published in our profession, but I'm not always so sure that it's a great fit. I still see the same names publishing all the time. Those seem to be the names that are always being picked up for courses. And I just don't know about that. So I think I'd love to see sort of a broader sweep, you know, like when with our book, it's kind of half edited and it's half edited and half written by me and Maddie Clark. And so we've had a lot of control over it in terms of trying to bring in diverse voices and people at different levels and, you know, all of those kinds of things. But sometimes I'm not sure that that's happening, but books with more popular first authors or editors are the ones that are getting picked up and used. So I'm not sure what to do about it, but that's one of those things that always occurs in my mind of, you know, how do we get, I don't know if it's better books, but more diversity of books into faculty hands, because I know that there's a lot of publishing going on.
Yeah, some really great points, Jen. Helped me out kind of come up with what I think might be something that I'm thinking about with this answer. I've had the good fortune to work with a couple people, certainly not with my name on a book, but just to see how they write and what their process is. I didn't know that like some books are just written in a Word document. I thought there was maybe a special software for this. But in regard to what you're talking about the same people kind of writing the same books, I think a lot of college students would certainly have the opinion of, you know, I've got to buy a new edition 2 years from the last edition. And that I think is something that frustrates me. And I'm sure many other people of like, okay, this book has 14 editions. Why? You know, is it worth updating a single chapter in those books? Maybe. But, you know, I think one of the things that does frustrate me about seeing books published is, oh gosh, we've just got another edition out and I thought I wouldn't have to buy the new one. And I have the old one and now I've got to return that and buy the new one. Kind of obscene to me.
I definitely get that, Mitch. So I took this question a little bit differently because I also have never written a book. And I have been reading a lot of fiction lately, especially like the new fiction that's coming out that, you know, it's really a quick read and it's kind of fun, lighthearted. And my comment on the state of book publishing in the fiction world is that every single story is the same. And I don't know if this is because we can't come up with new storylines or what, but every single book that I've been reading, you know, and these are like popular, you know, fantasy, fiction, whatever, you know, the pop culture of book world, that's what I've been noticing is that every single storyline is the same. So I don't know if that's a comment on human nature. We're just recycling everything over and over again. But it's interesting.
I've done lots of book chapters and actually like writing that stuff. I did two books. One I co-authored with Betsy Page on group work, and we signed on to a publisher who was really interested in the book, and we wanted to make it sort of the skill development book for group work. And the publisher, in the middle of us producing the book, got bought out by a larger publisher and then became a smaller press of the larger publisher. And guess what happened with our book? It got finished and it got buried because the larger publisher had the same names that you see over and over publishing group work books. So I've always felt some cynicism about the publishing situation with publishers. The second book I did, we decided to do do as an edited book, and we decided to produce it. I was interested in producing it as a demonstration book for an online book, and we published it through Amazon, and to also kind of project our true feelings about the cost of textbooks, we charged $15 for it, just to kind of say, we're not in it for the money, and also say, we also know people who are going to want this book. We don't kind of need you as the middleman or bookie anymore. So I think publishing as it stands is kind of an archaic way of doing things by publishing textbooks. It's not how we consume information anymore. And the assumption is that if it goes through a publisher, it has a higher level of credibility. And that's just not the case. It's not a complete assurance that the book has more credibility. And then they're overreaching with their costs. Textbooks are out of this world. It's a real niche market. With one book that I got into a discussion with was a multicultural book. They wanted to extend it from counseling to psychology to social work to all helping fields. And it was like, that's not what we're writing this book for. But the marketing, I understand what you're trying to do with the marketing, and we just let that go after that point. So I think people are not paying. Publishers are trying to stay alive and treading water, because that's not how we consume information anymore.
No, these are great answers. Because I myself am quite cynical. I'll say, Mitch, on the upside, now they're looking at new editions maybe 6 to 10 years, which even in Psychopharm, that's cutting it close. But I'm also like, yeah, I get it. And then they're like, do you need a new edition, or can you do electronic addendi? You know, and we can just, and I guess you could do that. But I'm thinking back to the day when one person, initials GC, I'm not going to mention names, wrote all these books, but it was the same book over and over and over and over. And then they'd sell hundreds of thousands of those, and anything else kind of got buried. And I had an experience with a psychopath book. My buddy and I spent a lot of time on it. It won an award from the American Psychological Association, but Pearson just let it run out because it wasn't selling well enough. And it's like, well, I don't know, man. It's pretty frustrating. Authors are treated, leave it to me to pick like music and writing books as two of my areas of interest, you know, two areas where you're constantly getting shite upon. It's sad, but it's also, yeah, I don't think we need new editions every few years. That's for certain. But as Marty said, too, like a lot of times publishers, they have their little favorites for some reason, and everything else they don't push. So it was a great way to get tenure and promotion to full professor. But the process, I think of Robert Anton Wilson, who said every publisher should have a pimp as an older brother so they have someone to look up.
Well, I will just add in, and I will name names on this, Cresswell's Research Methods book, I swear, is probably like in its, you know, 36th edition or something. They have a new one come out every year. And I'm like, you know, there's not that much new under the sun, and it's a pretty thin little volume. And I remember, like, I just kept getting these desk copies show up, and I'm like, this is not that different. I would never make a student buy another new copy. But I just had to get in on that, Mitch, because I pay attention to that too. And I don't like updating the book just to update the book, besides the fact that it's a lot of work for me to have to translate it to the new edition. But students don't need to be paying that money. All right, I'll shut my mouth and move to my question now. So what is your opinion about the 4-day work week?
Yeah, I know my opinion on it has changed since COVID. I think that we probably could operate under the idea that we perhaps might be making the same amount of money, or that if there was a day work week implemented, it would be about that, maybe in an ideal world. For me, I was totally down with the 4-day work week. And I'm just like, however I can spend like less time at work, the better. And I still definitely think that, but I think this question does depend on the job. Because I think if you, for instance, if what you're doing doesn't feel like work, you might be more incentivized to go and do it. So if, for instance, I can imagine like being a professor at a university or being a counselor, things that I'm thinking about are things that appeal to me. And spending more time doing that stuff might be interesting. Now, is that something where I only want to do a 4-day work week or I only want to do a 5-day work week? Some days I'll probably feel like being there 0 days, 0-day work week. But I imagine that it does depend on the job. I've kind of come around on this to have, I'm not exactly sure what I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I went back and forth on this question because I want to love it. And I am a really big fan of my like 2 to 3 day work week of going in. And then I do work every day. So like emails and grading and all that stuff. But I like to do that on my time and like what works for my schedule at home. And I think that that's just been something recently, you know, ever since having a child, that has been really, really critically important. Like, yes, it's good to get out of the house and go and teach my classes and attend the 90,000 meetings that I have to go to. And on top of that, you know, taking my time to actually grade and course prep and do all that when I want to is important. So that's how my work week looks and how I've structured it. And yeah, so I don't know if that's a 4-day work week or a 7-day with like 2 days. I don't know. I don't know what you would call it, but it's a blend of all of it.
Yeah, I'm with you, Gina. So instead of working and having 2 days off that I work on, I get to work and have 3 days off that I work on. I frankly, power to the people. I think it's a great option for hourly workers. They have some choices. It allows them some flexibility, but absolutely no impact on my life other than to make me feel even more guilty about working as much as I do, because now I should be taking my 3 days off instead of my 2 days off. Yeah.
I like all the answers. I like Mitch. Marty, I agree with you. I think it depends on the job. But I think human beings need to liberate themselves from the delusion of time. So for me, it really doesn't make any difference. I've worked in landscaping. I've worked in government projects. I've worked in academia. And I've found, the people who love their work, they're kind of always there. People who don't love their work, they find ways to turn their work week into like a 3-day. I kind of feel like people will figure out a way to do it without like a norm. But hey, for hourly jobs, I agree. I think that's more than enough tedium.
Yeah. Where I was thinking with this really was around our hourly wage folks. A lot of them, you know, you think the eight hours a day, it's kind of arbitrary, not to mention like with 5 days, you got to clean yourself up, drive yourself there. You know, we have the luxury in our business a lot of the time to be able to make our own schedules, to go to our preferred work area when we want. Sans meetings, of course, right? Like we've got to go turn up for those things. But, you know, that's the privilege that comes with having higher education and being in specific roles that brings. We may not be making the big bucks in terms of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, but we do have our time and the way that we structure our time. And that is a lot of privilege that comes with our profession as counselor educators. I think as counselors, you know, when I started thinking about this and applying it to them, I think that it could get harder if it was a 4-day week, because that would mean more clients in one day. But I also started to think, well, maybe we might actually, if we were on 4-day work week, so 10-hour days, and we're not talking, you know, settings such as IOP or, you know, things like that, but more of, you know, the general clinical mental health and not residential, not hospitalization, where it's a very different way that you spend your time. But maybe there then would be time for more clinical supervision. Maybe there would be more time to actually engage clinicians in research, because there's clinicians, you know, who would love to be able to collect data and to partner and do participatory action research and things of that nature, but they feel so pressed within the hour constraint, you know, to be able to make that happen. I don't know. I think I can see the pros and cons for, you know, kind of run of the mill clinical mental health, not the specializations where you have a captive audience, but thinking about where might the other options lie if we were on a 4-day week rather than 5.
My question is, if you could swap lives with any fictional character for a day, who would it be? And what would you hope to gain from the experience?
I love this question so much, Mitch. I have thought about this for the past several hours. I have done research on this. I have like seriously looked into this because I am such a book nerd. Like I mentioned before, I've been doing a lot of reading, and my initial reaction was to go with one of my, and I think I've mentioned this on here before, that I have never really been a fantasy book reader until like the past 6 months. And I've just gone down a total fantasy rabbit hole. And so now I'm like, that's what I would pick. I would want to be in like some fantastical world and, you know, be able to fly or whatever, do something crazy. And then I realized in the wording of your question, we would have to swap lives for a day. And I was like, okay, so in this current book that I'm reading, they're doing something called a Kajari, where they fight and battle to the death. And like, there's 25 of them and they're vampires and human and whatever. And I don't think I would fare well in that situation. So I don't think I'd last a full day. I think I would have a very hard time. So then I switched my answer and I went back to my historical fiction. And I think my final answer, instead of all the, you know, vampires and fairies and whatever, I would much rather go back to like Pride and Prejudice and be Elizabeth Bennet, which is like a very classic answer, but I think it would be more fun to wear like a frilly dress for a day and like walk around on your, I don't know, British lawn. It would be cool.
Mitch, I really hate this question. And I say that only because I had a hard time settling on a fictional character. And then it was like, actually right during the show, I said, Hercule Poirot. I think I would now. And then part of your question is swap lives. I would like to be Hercule Poirot for a day, the David Suchet version, not the Kenneth Branagh version, and would like Hercule Poirot to be in my life for a day. That would be the fun part of it, because it's a actual swap. But I think what I'd like to walk away from that, and what I'd like to have an experience with, would be for me to get inside his head and how he thinks, and his observational and deductive reasoning would be really fascinating to experience that point of view for a day. So, Hercule Poirot.
Yeah, for me, it would be Leopold Bloom from That Long Day of Ulysses on June 16th. And because everything that could possibly happen happens in Ulysses, I would hope to aim for some measure of transcendent experience, perhaps something that's a bit of a wake-up call, Satori of sorts. But yeah, that one, I love the question. And that was like immediately, well, who's the character who experienced the most in history or postmodern history of literature? It would be Leopold Bloom from Ulysses.
Well, it was funny listening to Gina, because Gina was thinking she's showing up as her and into these roles. I'm like thinking I'm going to get to embody the character. And so, of course, I went with Jack Reacher from the Lee Child novels, because, you know, he's like 6'5". He beats everyone's ass all over the place. Like, he doesn't put up with any shit, you know. And then he just walks out of town, you know, like this whole drama goes down. And then he just gets on the Greyhound and he is out, you know, with his toothbrush in his pocket, his ATM card and his passport, right? Like, this is it for Jack Reacher. And I've read them all, and especially love the ones that, no offense, that aren't written with the sun. They're just not as good. And let's be honest, this is the written Jack Reacher, not the show, not the movie, not the BS with freaking Tom Cruise, 5'6". They clearly inverted those numbers, because Jack Reacher was 6'5" and a Hulk, you know? So I'm a big person already. I'm 6 feet tall, but like, I want to be the giant who can just go in and kick ass and take names. Anyone want to interpret that? Okay.
So I'm having a bit of a crisis here, in that when I posed this question, I didn't read the question, and it says swap lives. And everyone has been talking about how we're actually swapping lives. So it would be someone who would be in my body too, and I'd be coming back and hopefully my body would be okay. I can now think of like the worst person, I think, to swap bodies with for a day. And I'm just going to go with Superman, because I feel like there's no way I'm going to get back in that body, because Superman is going to think that he's still invincible and is going to go out there and do something really stupid. And I'm going to come back and I'm not going to have a body to swap back into, and I'll be in the void. Who knows? But I wish I could go with my original answer, but this whole swapping body things, is that's throwing me off.
That's the beauty of Leopold Bloom. Nothing changes.
Everyone, that's because you made your question too hard, Mitch.
It's too hard for me now.
I mean, come on, dumb it down for the rest of us, because clearly, like, the only person who could handle it was Gina.
Well, now I'm having second thoughts, and I'm imagining Jack Reacher just taking care of Millie, making pancakes, cutting them up, making little
hearts. I kind of love that picture.
That was a great one. Okay. So my question is, what is your favorite part of the day?
Oh, this is morning, early morning, really early morning, like 5 o'clock in the morning. Usually that's the time that I get up, go downstairs, make a cup of coffee, sit in a chair for a while, kind of process my whole day. And frankly, as long as I don't have to be anywhere, Aileen comes down, we talk about what's going to go on in the day. But after that, if I don't have to be anywhere, I don't have to shower, which kind of is a big interruption for me. And I can sit down and get right to work. And it's always the most creative part of the day for me. That is all triggered by the fact that I used to do morning drive in radio. So I'd have to get up early in the morning and got used to that schedule of being on and having the energy and having the stuff, the mojo that you need to be able to do that on radio. So it's early in the morning. It's way too early. I put things off in the evening and just get up in the morning and hammer them out instead of trying to struggle through the evening to get things done.
Yeah, I think for me, it would be the gloaming or the witching hour. But the gloaming part of the day, as things are fading to dark, that's kind of where I thrive. I do great after the summer solstice. Up to the summer solstice, I just have to kind of like gird myself every day. And then the darker it gets, the better I get. So yeah, I'd say the gloaming as it heralds the witching hour, but you still have about 6 hours in between.
So funny you mentioned that, Elliot, because now that I've moved south, I'm really worried about what's going to happen to me in winter of not having my short days, because for whatever reason, I really got into my groove with that. And I think that's part of the reason why I do love the early morning. And I love the night. I want to eliminate the afternoon completely. I should be in a siesta culture. That's just the bottom line, because I want to have a nice lunch and then lay my ass down. Like, I am completely dysfunctional in the afternoon. And this semester, I'm going to be teaching at 2 p.m. So I don't know about all that. But the early morning, it feels like I'm back in the swing of it. You know, I'm back getting up 5-6 in the morning, doing my writing, working on my research. Like, it feels good. It feels normal. I like the evening because it's cooler, and I like to sit outside and see the birds and see the sun start to go down and that whole thing. You know, we eat dinner late in my family. We always have. So, you know, it's hard for me to go to bed early because we always ate between 8 and 9 p.m. So that was something that started when I was young, and, you know, it continues to this day. And plus, I've taught at night for so many years that I've been in that schedule. So it's interesting. The afternoon is my least good time. I'm needing my siesta, and apparently I'm getting sent to the classroom at that time this semester. So we'll see how it goes. The long days and no siesta.
Yeah, I like this question a lot because it got me thinking about the differences between times of day for me. And I think my favorite time is right around as soon as it hits midnight. I used to have a interesting work schedule where typically my waking hour and free time started around 12 midnight. And I just found that it was just so peaceful without the hustle and bustle of everything going around. And I didn't know that I preferred that. But it always seems very calming to me when I feel like I'm the only one in the world awake. Now, I mean, I don't really go out and do anything after 12 a.m. But yeah, I kind of like that time around as soon as it gets real dark out and, you know, there's not too much going on.
I love hearing about these because I think it's so interesting how everyone's a little bit different. I agree the most with Marty. Mine early mornings are the ones for me. I have grown up swimming, and in swimming, for whatever reason, you have practice at like 5 a.m. every day, which means you need to get out of bed at like 4 a.m. And I lived really far from where I swam, so I'd have to drive. And I used to hate that. And that used to be like the hardest part of my life, period, was like dragging myself out of bed and dragging myself to swimming and then diving into a cold pool. Like, what in the world was I thinking? Now, after years and years and years of doing that, I did that through high school and college. Now I find that I just wake up naturally, and it helps that my child also wakes up at 5 a.m. naturally and gets me out of bed. But I love the morning. I love the sunrise. I love seeing all the different colors come across the sky, just like the eve of possibility. I don't know, like it's this great potential of the day, and it feels really productive usually, and like you're optimistic about the day and what's to come. So early mornings for me too, and it feels peaceful. And kind of like what you were saying, Mitch, like it feels like I'm the only one up because there's no traffic, you know, when you're going to swimming or whatever. And so that's always really nice too. Peaceful.
I enjoyed early morning after I finished or took a break from working in radio when I was writing my dissertation, because I could get up. The kids were still asleep. Aileen was still asleep. And there was nothing to distract me on television. And that's when I transferred that productivity of radio into productivity of dissertation. So kind of fit into my lifestyle at that point. I want to give you some options on my question. What is the hardest part of your job as a student or as a counselor or as a counselor educator?
I guess for me, I spread it across counselor educator and section coordinator and department chair, because they're all kind of academically interwoven. But personnel, dealing with people, whether it's dealing with student disagreements or colleagues, or when you're supervising people, faculty members, hands down, 80% of the work and only about 1% of it's joyful.
On the whole, I'm going to speak to being counselor educator. I don't mind any parts of my job. What I don't like is the bureaucracy and the undercurrents of power and power playing that often happens within university settings. I would say that that's where I'm not a fan. Like, change happens. Okay, fine. But do you have to do it where you're throwing your weight? That's where I start to have a hard time within the professional role, because, you know, gatekeeping, nobody loves it, but I don't hate it. Grading, I don't hate it. Writing, research, don't hate it. Service, love meeting new people. You know, I'm kind of one of those weird people who like all four of our main areas that are associated with our job, but I think it's that undercurrent of bureaucracy and power playing that oftentimes is coming from the top. Like, we have no say and no power. And even the chair just goes, sorry, you know, let's live into it, because that's what we're on today. You know, I would say that's the hardest part of the job.
Yeah, I was thinking about the idea of staying in the moment. And I think it's gotten a lot easier for me over time, especially now because I'm at a program that I love and I enjoy going there every day. I also know that there's something that I'm looking forward to after I graduate, getting into doing counseling all the time. And I think it's sometimes that I can get caught up in the future goals as opposed to staying in and enjoying each day, enjoying each class. Like, there's some classes that I wish that I could just like, I either want to take them again, or I want to have like, actually, we didn't, you know, we could have gotten more material. We could have talked about more theories. Like, can you imagine? But I think that's something that I've been really trying to work towards is, you know, I don't want to have I don't think it's beneficial for me to be thinking about like, oh, I just want to get to the end of this semester, or I just want to get to the end of this project. Like, it's all part of the process. And I think I'm trying to enjoy that more, but it's still a challenge.
Yeah, I agree with Jen. I love every element of my job as a counselor educator. And when I first read this question, I thought, maybe gatekeeping. Those are sometimes difficult, raw, vulnerable conversations. And then I was like, oh, I kind of love that. Like, I kind of love having those heart to hearts. And I think that that can be a really positive thing, even if it is hard. Then I thought, like, maybe the 80 meetings a week, that's kind of hard. But then the real answer came to me. And I really struggle with this one. And it's maintaining those boundaries. And you all know this about me, that I have a hard time saying no. And this is my, like, 2 weeks of vacation where nobody can bother me and I don't have to attend meetings and I don't have to teach classes and I've got to do a little course prep, whatever, but I enjoy that. And I've already had so many students reaching out, asking to meet, talking about this next, you know, and we don't even start until September and it's mid-August. And I'm like, I have such a hard time saying no and being like, you know, listen to my out of office email message. Because I want to help and I want to be there and I want to engage in those conversations with students. And yet I also have to take time for myself. And I think that that's something that I'm learning in this season is how to do that and how to separate that a little bit more. So that's been the biggest challenge for me. It's just keeping those boundaries clear.
This question came up because I already had the answer for me. And the answer was grading. And I know, Jen, you said you're fine with grading. It's okay. But grading is my kryptonite. You have to provide some measure of performance in a class. And that means you have to grade that measure of performance. And having to read the same answer to the same question 20 times and stay engaged in, focused and in the moment in the response. And sometimes trying to figure out students' twisted ways of saying things. Grading, I just dread grading, but we have to do it. That's part of the job for me. And that is probably the hardest part of the job for me. That's it for all of our questions for tonight. We have a final shot question. Ruin a class in 4 words.
Are we allowed to use contractions?
I don't see why. Well, I'll mark you down on grading if you do, but you can still submit that as an answer.
I can use it without the contraction. Here it is. The colostomy bag's leaking.
Oh, well, funny enough, I went down the same road. Everyone cut the cheese.
I'm going to go with let's talk about politics.
My water just broke.
I went with show your surgery scars. And actually, if I would have had 5 words, it would have been everybody. Show your surgery scars. That's it for the firing squad. Hope you don't run into any of this stuff when you're in a classroom. If you are, run in the opposite direction, but realize that we brought it to you first. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on the podtalk.net. Thanks to the firing squad, Jen, Gina, Mitch, Elliot, for joining us tonight. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on the podtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Our theme music is from Menage a Quad, Real Swing Shet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, go.